Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Wednesday morning, and thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, why President Trump's cabinet is considered one of the worst in history, and how changes at the World Trade Organization could affect Arizona and Mexico.
But first, today, the State Human Resources Office says the administrator of the statewide retirement program for public safety personnel should be fired after he admitted to sexually harassing an employee, among other things. Jared Smout has been placed on paid leave, and the Public Safety Personnel Retirement System Board is scheduled to decide what to do next this afternoon. Craig Harris of the Arizona Republic has been following the story and joins us now. Hey, Craig.
Hi, good morning.
So what exactly is Mr. Smout accused of here?
Well, he's accused of sexually harassing a staff worker. It's not clear if it was a male or female. He has also admitted to, they found that 5 years ago, he had spent countless hours using an in-house video surveillance monitor to look at another staff member for hours on end. That was apparently hidden from the board. And so he has admitted to both of those things, in addition to not properly handling accusations that he spied on staff with the IT department. And so he's looking to could be fired this afternoon.
Yeah, and this could have happened yesterday, right? The board met yesterday, and there was speculation that he might be outed yesterday. What happened?
Well, I think they're being very careful. We had raised the issue of whether they properly had posted this as an open meetings situation. And so I think as an abundance of caution, they wanted to make sure they properly put it on the agenda, and they gave 24 hours notice. And so they wanted to have all their I's dotted and all their T's crossed. So the delay wasn't necessarily that big of a deal, except they just wanted to make sure they did everything properly by the state open meetings law.
Craig, any reason to think this is not going to be the end of the line for Smout today?
I would imagine he'd be fired today. The board, I asked board members yesterday what they're going to do. They've kept things close to the chest. It would seem with all the damning information in the state investigation that, you know, they would have really no choice but to fire him, especially when you have the governor's office, the personnel office saying, get rid of this guy. The governor appoints some of the members to this board. You would imagine they would go through and follow through with that.
Is there a way to gauge how decent, good, awful he's been at the job beyond these accusations? Was he someone worth having around because the organization and the fund was doing well, or has it not been doing well?
The fund's been doing very poorly. Okay. As a matter of fact, one of the board members yesterday said it was insolvent, which got some criticism from other board members, but he pointed out it's a $10 billion fund. They need about $20 to $25 billion. That is the definition of insolvent when you only have half the money you need to pay for pension benefits. Under his watch, he also handed out huge bonuses, huge raises to investment staffers, despite the fact that the Pew Charitable Trust rated that system one of the worst in the country for performance. So when you compare them to pension systems across the country, they have had very poor results, and they've had horrible results when you compare them to the Arizona State Retirement System, which is very well run, and even also the State Treasurer's Office, which runs the land fund for the First State Education Department.
Craig, given all the attention that pension funds in this state have been getting over the last number of years, with a number of them, as you referenced, being underfunded, with everything else going on, how has he been allowed to stay on for as long as he has? If he, in addition to all the other stuff, if the fund itself is not doing that well?
Well, the pension system has a board that's appointed, was mostly appointed by the governor, and now it's appointed by legislative leaders and the governor. Some of the critics would say part of the problem is that you've had a board for the last several years that's been chaired by a firefighter. It's currently chaired by a police officer. And you might want to scratch your head, because I don't think firefighters or police officers would want a chief financial officer or an accountant to run their department. So you've got people on the board that don't really have experience with finances or money running a system, and they're also personal beneficiaries of the trust. So there's not really an arm's length oversight of some of the members who are on this board in that they have owned their own personal benefit. As a matter of fact, the person who's the former chairman of the board, he's going to walk away with about a $750,000 lump sum pension payment from a system that's horribly underfunded. So you don't have, in the main, the entire board, people on there who are expertise on finances. Now, you have some folks on the board who are really, really good at that. But in the main, the mix is not a group of people who know how to run a pension system.
Okay, we'll wait and see at the end of the day whether Jared Smout is out. I did not mean to rhyme that. Craig Harris, the Arizona Republic, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Last year, Hispanics saw their biggest gain in homeownership since before the Great Recession, and Hispanic homeownership gains over the past decade accounted for nearly 63% of all gains nationwide. Those are among the findings of the new State of Hispanic Homeownership Report from the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. With me to talk more about this is Ana Benavides. She's been a realtor for 25 years and is founding president of the Greater Phoenix Chapter of the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. And Ana, to what do you attribute these numbers?
Hispanics want to own a piece of land. It makes them, the family, stronger, the ties stronger. It's part of their culture, and they are part of their dream of becoming part of the United States. They're also changing. The Hispanics are growing. We are into probably second or third generations now. And so that is changing a lot. Education is changing also among the Hispanics. We're having more graduates in from college. And so the socioeconomics of them is changing. So those parents who came in several years ago, who were the first ones to land into the United States, they probably didn't have the economics to make the dream happen. But as the kids are born here, going to college, and they're socioeconomics, their income is increasing, then the dream is coming through.
This doesn't sound terribly dissimilar to what we've heard about with other groups of immigrants to the U.S. in years and years past.
No, it doesn't, doesn't it?
Hispanics, as you point out in the report, were particularly hard hit during the recession, during the housing crisis. Is there anything in particular that has enabled this particular population to sort of bounce back along with other groups that have also started getting back into the housing market?
Well, they got hit very hard. There was a lot of advantage taking against them. Okay, they were taking some of those very unusual loans were done with the Hispanic community, and a lot of people lost their homes because of it. I have to say that it hasn't been an easy rebound because they still scare. They still concerned about the lending systems. So when the crashes happened and the children, the millennials, saw their parents losing their homes, okay, it got scared. All right. However, I have to tell you that the same parents who lost their homes are the ones who are pushing the children to buy homes.
It's interesting that you say that parents are pushing their kids to buy homes, because you hear so much about, especially potential first-time home buyers, millennials, people in their 20s and maybe early 30s, who watched their parents go through the Great Recession, are not interested in owning a home anymore. They're renting, they're, you know, maybe in an apartment or a condo or something like that, not in a single-family home. You're saying in the Hispanic community, that's not necessarily the case anymore.
That is true. I see a lot of this generation buying homes, okay? And they're buying it because they really, the parents are wanting them to get better. They've seen what the economy has done. Yes, we do have a crash, you know, the crash. Yes, they lost their homes. Yes, they saw how a home that it was $180,000 went down to $40,000, especially in some of the areas of Maryvale, South Phoenix, and the skirts of the city. But they also have seen how those have rebound, and now they're back to the 180s and the 200s. So they see that was one of the vehicles to produce this wealth, okay, in the United States.
Are there particular parts of the valley where Hispanic homebuyers are looking to buy?
Well, The income has increased. So I believe that now the median income for the Hispanic community is in the 50,000, okay? So income-wise, we have increased, but that happy medium of home, it's now in the 230s, 250s, okay? So that makes it very difficult for them to buy homes. And so you can only find those prices in the skirts of the city right now, or in some other areas inside the city.
You talked about parents often sort of pushing their kids to buy homes. On the parents' part, is there an expectation that their kids will try to buy homes near where the parents live?
Not necessarily. The one thing our culture does is that we remain together. We always help our parents. And we are not those that tend to put our parents into nursing homes, okay? We keep them at home with us. But I also noticed that education is becoming a key element. So school districts are becoming a concern for some of them.
Do you anticipate that this trend will continue?
Yes. Yes. You see it where some of the new builders are creating homes where they have an attachment, or they have a little guest quarters, or they have the mother and daughter set up, okay, because that's the trend that we are going to see.
All right. That's Ana Benavides, a realtor and founding president of the Greater Phoenix Chapter of the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. Ana, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me here, too.
The headquarters for the Bureau of Land Management, which oversees hundreds of millions of acres of public land, will soon be moving out of Washington, D.C. and into the West. The Department of the Interior made the announcement yesterday, saying most of the BLM's Washington employees will be sent to posts across the West, while the agency's director, deputy director, and staff will be based in the small Colorado city of Grand Junction. Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg is based in Grand Junction and joins us from there. Stina, good morning.
Good morning.
So Grand Junction, a city of less than 60,000 people, hours away from any metro area. So what's the BLM's rationale for moving so far away from Washington?
So the idea is that this move west is going to get the decision makers from the agency more in touch with the land it actually oversees. You know, Colorado's Republican U.S. Senator Cory Gardner, he's been beating this drum for years. He first came up with the idea in 2016. And his idea is that, you know, it's going to get the decision makers closer to the people whose decisions they impact, and it'll get the constituents closer to the decision makers so they can actually have more of a say. And one of the things he really loves to say is that, you know, 99% of all BLM land is west of the Mississippi, and Grand Junction is more than 70% BLM land. So as he sees it, it makes a lot of sense.
Stina, what's been the reaction to this move in Grand Junction?
Shock, elation. I mean, like, this has been talked about for years as a possibility, but it was just sort of floated around as, oh, maybe, you know. So now that it's happened, people are still really happy, even though it's only 27 employees that are moving here. The fact that it's the director and the deputy directors that are going to move here, I think that just is going to lead a lot of, you know, add a lot of prestige to Grand Junction. And, you know, it's sort of like if this sort of thing happened in Prescott or Flagstaff, it just would mean a lot to everyone, even though the numbers are small. I will say, though, that I got this email after I did a bunch of two-ways yesterday, and this woman told me she was really angry about it. She lives here in Grand Junction. She doesn't want them to come, and she's afraid that the housing prices will go up and also that the traffic will get bad. And she's like, I don't want this place to become a hellhole like Denver.
And no doubt, we know there are critics across the country as well, not just around that area. What are they saying about this?
A good conversation with the Public Lands Foundation yesterday. It's a nonprofit group. It's made up mostly of former public lands employees, mostly BLM employees. They are strongly opposed. You know, they're saying that it doesn't make sense to move all these people out of Washington, D.C., because there's about 350 employees in D.C. that work for the BLM. And there will only be 60 after this. All these moves are completed. And they say those hundreds of employees were needed in D.C. to, you know what was going on, to be included in these decision-making processes. And there's already close to 10,000 employees in the West already that work for the BLM. So there's a worry that this is just going to decentralize things in a way that won't work.
Stina, there's also some congressional opposition too, right?
Oh, yeah. So I spoke with Representative Raul Grijalva yesterday. He is strongly opposed. You know, and he's worried about the same thing that, you know, some other BLM employees, some BLM employees are worried about, that some folks won't actually move and this will be a way to sort of pare down the agency. But the other thing he's really concerned about is that if you move to Grand Junction, you're moving close to public land, but you're also moving close to a lot of oil and gas interests. And his fear is that it will allow, you know, these employees to get kind of cozy with these special interests without the oversight of Washington.
Stina Sieg of Colorado Public Radio and the soon-to-be stronghold of the BLM, Grand Junction. Stina, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much.
Before President Trump even took office, frankly, before he was elected, there was a sizable collection of Republicans who fell into the camp labeled Never Trumpers. So when the president-elect began his string of interviews at Mar-a-Lago, the names often weren't as familiar as we'd become used to in previous GOP-led administrations. And to many, that has affected the relative strength of his cabinet. Alex Nazarian of Yahoo News explores all of that in his new book, The Best People, Trump's Cabinet and the Siege on Washington. And he's with me via Skype to talk about that. Alex, how many of the initial challenges faced in choosing this cabinet had to do with the so-called Never Trumpers and the number of people who said they simply never wanted to work for this president?
Well, that's a very good question. And the fact that there was a large swath of the Republican establishment that would have nothing to do with the president-elect, of course, figured into the formation of the cabinet. But at the same time, we knew there was a Never Trump movement for months before the election. There was a Never Trump movement pretty much from the moment he rode down the escalator in 2015. And they never prepared. They never cultivated, a group of policy experts who would be willing to work on the, you know, in the cabinet. It's because they never thought they would win. They didn't think they would win. So they never bothered bringing with them people who would come to Washington if they did win. And so, of course, Washington was empty and remains empty in the sense that the federal bureaucracy is just not stocked with the kind of best people Trump promised to hire.
Now, would the administration argue with a spin that that was their intention to not do traditional Washington?
They would, and they have, and they did to me. But it's clearly not in their best interest to have things running this way. For example, just think about the fact that we haven't had a Senate-confirmed defense secretary since Jim Mattis left. Trump has never had a confirmed immigrations and customs head. He's never had somebody at ICE who's Senate-confirmed. He likes these acting deputies or acting secretaries because he says that gives him leverage, but that leverage comes at the expense of those people's expertise and their influence over their own staff, and it just kind of cultivates this feeling of chaos. Now, I know they like the chaos. Trump likes the chaos, but it doesn't serve him well.
When we consider some of the history of some of the best presidents and some of the better cabinets, I mean, even some presidents who've been criticized deeply, there are still some sort of standout cabinet members that are shining stars in a sense. Is it unfair to say that this administration really hasn't had any shining cabinet stars? I mean, maybe General Mattis, but of course he quit. So,
look, I mean, Mattis is the primary person that you would go to for that. I think it's hard to think of anyone else who has really. I can't even think, frankly, of anyone who served Trump well, who has acted in Trump's best interests. I mean, look, let's be honest. Could a smart, determined Republican president have executed a hardline border agenda? Yes. Could it have been done without this incredible cruelty and incompetence that we're seeing? You could have done this same policy, which I personally don't agree with, millions of Americans don't agree with. You could have done it without these horrific images, these horrific reports. It just speaks to the incredible level of incompetence.
And how much cronyism has there been? I mean, in the past, we've seen some friends of the president or donors of the president get a cabinet position. Has it been even more obvious and obnoxious in this case?
Oh, It's been astonishing. And look, let's be clear. Every administration says there will be no room for lobbyists. Every administration breaks that promise the second they realize that lobbyists are often the people who understand how government works better than anyone else in the government. Obama had lobbyists. Clinton, Bush had lobbyists. They didn't have scandals every single day. They didn't have scandals of such astonishing magnitude. You thought you were reading about a third world kleptocracy instead of the greatest democracy in the world. That's the disconnect. It's not that he's the first president to have to face the fact that some of the people he hired were corrupt. He's the first one to have essentially a cabinet entirely formed of corrupt administrators. And that we've never had.
And so when you had a chance to talk with the president about his cabinet, generally, I don't know what you asked him, but in any way, did he indicate he was aware that these were not necessarily the best people? Or does he say, no, these people were the best. You're wrong.
Look, remember during the presidential campaign, during the primary, he went out there, I think it was at Mar-a-Lago, and he's standing there with his steaks and his vodka and his every other product. Like, this is the best. This is the best. Greatest vodka of all time. Greatest champagne of all time. And that's how he thinks. That's how he thinks. My honest sense was that he did not really know whom he was employing. That was my honest sense. So I appreciated that they gave me time with the president, but it was also clear that the president was only confirming what I suspected, which was that he had virtually no oversight of what was happening because he was so concerned with himself, right? Within just a few minutes, he was talking about Russia using a word that we can't say on public radio to describe the Mueller investigation. And he has said, he actually told Laura Ingraham of Fox News that I don't see why we need this many people. I am the sole decision maker. It's not that he's going to take responsibility for everything. It's just he's going to sort of be the main guy, the only guy. If that's your understanding of how Washington works, you do not understand Washington.
Alex Nazarian is the author of The Best People, Trump's Cabinet, and the Siege on Washington. The departure of Mexico's ambassador from the World Trade Organization could complicate trade disputes between the U.S. and Mexico, Arizona's largest trading partner. Bloomberg News reports Mexico's current trade representative to the WTO in Geneva is preparing to leave. This follows news that Mexico's president could also close Mexico's trade office in Washington to free up money for domestic spending programs. Joining us to find out more about what this means is Sapna Gupta, a senior policy analyst at the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU. Sapna, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So your research focuses on trade between Mexico and the U.S. Let's talk about if Mexico does pull its ambassador from the WTO. Does that bode ill for trade agreements, or does it have nothing to do with that?
Actually, it's in between the two. So if Mexico pulls its ambassador from the WTO, that means that it's reinvesting its efforts in domestic policies. The WTO itself is an international organization with representatives from each country. Over 160 countries participate in the WTO. Its main role is to enforce and establish rules and regulations that govern global trade, as well as to arbitrate when there's trade disputes between countries. So actually, in terms of the negotiations that are happening on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which is a follow-up to NAFTA between the U.S. and Mexico, that should not have an impact on it. To some degree, it could be a distraction to Mexican authorities that are and officials who are negotiating with the U.S. Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer. However, what's important to know is that the individual negotiations going on between the U.S. and Mexico are done at the federal level with a different office, not the WTO.
When you're talking about something as potentially impactful as the new NAFTA, as you referred, how significant could that kind of distraction be? I mean, could that be a big problem or maybe just more of a bump in the road?
I think it leans more towards being a bump in the road because, again, Mexico and the U.S. are trade partners. The U.S. is Mexico's most important trade partner. And right now, Mexico's trade with the U.S. is actually surpassing when it comes to manufactured goods with that of Canada, at least in the first part of the year. So both countries, the U.S. trade representative and the Mexican counterpart, will be very careful in terms of negotiating the new NAFTA, now known as the UMCA. However, in the U.S., the UMCA has not been ratified by Congress. And at this point, Congress is unlikely, or often elected officials, congressional officials, are reluctant to ratify an agreement during an election period.
So does not having an ambassador to the WTO potentially put Mexico at risk if there are trade disputes?
Well, what's important to know is that Mexico, by not having a representative to the WTO, yes, it would be at a slight disadvantage. It will not have a seat at the table. The Mexican ambassador to the WTO was the chair of a committee on rules and regulations. By removing him, it actually slows down the work of that committee that was establishing rules and regulation, and it removes Mexico's voice from it. So, yes, it's not good for the WTO to have a country like Mexico remove its trade representative. However, the WTO is an international organization. It has a staff. It has several committees. It can continue. However, the important thing is the signal that Mexico is sending to the WTO in terms of removing the ambassador. Now, these reports right now haven't been confirmed. The ambassador hasn't commented. However, the Mexican president, Manuel López Obrador, has put a resolution or law that would shift resources from trade offices to social programs. The law hasn't been ratified by both chambers, but it could be. And so that's a big signal.
It's interesting you mentioned sending a signal, because it seems like so much of international relations, so much of diplomacy is sort of sending these signals between different countries. And I'm interested in what kind of signal it might mean that Mexico would not have a representative at the WTO anymore.
Yeah, in terms of a signal for the WTO, it's an indication. It's more of a signal from President López Obrador to his constituency in Mexico, saying, here it is, I know the economy is slowing down, I am taking resources to focus on the people of Mexico. However, we can be confident that trade negotiations between the U.S. and Mexico will continue, trade negotiations between Mexico and other countries will continue. It is a signal, more than anything, to the Mexicans and the Mexican population.
Okay. Sapna Gupta is a senior policy analyst at the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU. Sapna, thanks for the time today.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. This is the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up in about 25 minutes, stay tuned for The Takeaway. It is monsoon season here in the Valley, and we're bringing our series Monsoon Stories this summer, and we need your help. This year, we're telling stories about how the monsoon storms tickle our five senses, how they look, feel, sound, smell, and taste. If you want to join in, just go to the monsoon.kjzz.org website and find out how to tell us your story or send us the best monsoon photo you've captured. Your story could end up on air, and your photo will be featured on our website.
A Maricopa County grand jury last week indicted Michael Paul Adams for first-degree murder in the death of a 17-year-old at a Peoria convenience store. Adams has said he stabbed Elijah Alamin after hearing rap music coming from the teen's car. His attorney has said Adams did not receive needed mental health training before being released from prison days earlier. A spokesman for the state corrections department, though, says Adams had not been designated seriously mentally ill. With me to talk about how the correction system identifies inmates with serious mental illnesses, or SMIs, and more, is Jose Ashford, director of the Office of Forensic Social Work at ASU. And Jose, first off, in general, do you think the state does right by people who have SMIs, both while they're incarcerated and then once they're released?
No, at this point in time, they lack sufficient resources, but at the same time, they're also hampered by some of the current policy requirements, some of the statutory requirements.
Like what?
Well, truth in sentencing, determinate sentencing. So in many ways, if a person is needing care in the community in the form of a conditional release, we eliminated in 1993, 1994 parole. And that makes it difficult for releasing individuals effectively into the community.
What ideally should be happening? Let's start when somebody enters the criminal justice system, when somebody is being screened before they enter jail or prison. What is happening and what should be happening?
Well, classification is the most important thing. You know, it's like in real estate, location, location, location. In the prison context and correctional systems, it's classification, classification, classification. So in many ways, individuals need to be screened to identify whether or not they have special needs. And those special needs would include mental health concerns.
What about that is not happening now?
Well, we do have a reception center where that's taking place. And in many ways, I think it's a question of volume. If a person enters in the system and there's not sufficient information provided to the correctional officials, then in many circumstances, a person can kind of fall through the cracks. It's interesting that in most systems, because of the high rate of persons being incarcerated, that individuals will be asked to self-identify.
It seems as though this would be, to your point earlier, an issue of resources where maybe prisons and jails and other correctional facilities don't have the staff or maybe even the knowledge to really get a sense independently whether or not somebody does have an SMI.
Yeah, I worked in the system early on when resources were available in other states. Give you an example, in Wisconsin, the period would be 30 to 60 days in reception, where you would have employed social workers who would do a thorough background check to basically find out information that would help in the classification process. At this current time, there are no social workers hired by the Department of Corrections, and so that impedes that, you know, component of the screening process.
Is prison really the best place to try to treat somebody with a serious mental illness, to try to help them through it or help them to get to a place where they can sort of function in society?
No, it's general consensus that persons with serious mental illnesses, that's not the appropriate place for them. And in many ways, you need differential responses depending upon the type of diagnosis the person has. And once again, a prison system is not as well equipped to deal with those variations.
What happens when somebody has served their term and they're set to be released? I mean, does the correction system have a way of helping those folks sort of make it on the outside? Is there some obligation they have to, you know, have them prepared with medication or have them hooked up with a therapist or a counselor or somebody to sort of monitor how they're doing?
At this point in time, I think the director is starting to institute policies for reentry. And that's kind of a national crisis now because we've really emphasized a shift in policy towards determinate sentencing, truth in sentencing. And so once a person reaches that maximum level of time served that is required by law, then they're just the institution has to automatically released. But the aims and justification for the system is no longer rehabilitation or correction. So in many ways, reentry is being neglected at multiple levels. And this is most critical for individuals who have special needs like serious mental illnesses.
So what's the answer then? I mean, it almost sounds like you're advocating for some kind of like midway step. Somebody maybe has served their term and doesn't need to be incarcerated anymore, but isn't quite ready to be sort of back on their own.
Yeah, and I think, you know, furlough programs try to test whether or not a person is ready for reentry. So a step-down program is one of the things that quite often is recommended. The evidence-based practices for reentry require that, let's say, 6 months prior to release, that individuals begin an individualized assessment of a person's needs. Then they establish a transition kind of level of intervention once the person is released, and then a follow-up period. And none of those are instituted at this point in time for individuals with serious mental illnesses in Arizona.
Well, what are the costs associated with that? I mean, it sounds like an extra step. I would imagine there's an extra cost there, too.
Yeah, we did a cost study of it, and it was more expensive, obviously, than someone who's just released from jail or prison. But when you saw, we witnessed a reduction in recidivism for violent offenses and other things. And when you start looking at that cost, then it's much cheaper.
All right. That's Jose Ashford. He is, among other things, director of the Office of Forensic Social Work in ASU's School of Social Work. Jose, thank you. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Learning a new language is considered a staple of education and human growth potential, and sometimes it happens in a classroom or online and maybe part of travel to a new place. But language programs have been slashed around the country, and there tends to be a focus on Spanish, French, and German. Our program at ASU is looking to reverse that trend and cement the importance of some less studied languages, such as Macedonian and Armenian. Irina Levin is the new director of the Critical Languages Institute and is with me to talk about her goals. So, Irina, first, how should we define critical languages?
It's defined in numerous ways. Certainly for the U.S. Department of Defense and U.S. Department of State, they've identified a number of languages, some of which we do teach, to be critical to the national interest, to national security, to our ongoing, you know, diplomatic efforts. So they have defined those not just based on how critical they are, but how few speakers there are currently in the U.S. And therefore, they offer incentives for people to learn those languages.
So how many are you going to be offering at ASU? How many possibilities are there now if people want to start?
Some of the languages we offered are, you know, don't fall into that
okay.
State Department. So I guess our definition of critical also has to do with our perceived kind of the absence of other options to learn these languages in the United States and our belief that the world is interconnected. And just because countries are small or have only a couple of million speakers, that doesn't mean that learning about those countries and being able to have cultural and linguistic fluency in those countries' languages isn't important. So we offer 12 different languages.
Okay. You can name them all if you'd
yes,
like.
Yes, I can. In alphabetical order, we offer Albanian, Armenian, Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian are one kind of language group, so that's taught as a single class. Hebrew, Indonesian, Macedonian, Persian, Polish, Russian, Turkish, Ukrainian, and Uzbek.
So from a learning curve standpoint, is it better to have fewer students? Because then in that case, maybe you're forced into conversation sooner if there are fewer of you?
Yeah, when there's two, you're talking all the time, right? Every other time, you're the one who has to kind
yes.
of produce.
It's obvious which one, if you're studying or not yeah. at that point, yes.
Yeah, so, and I observed all of our courses this summer, and including those courses with just a few students in them, and indeed, you know, every other homework question you're responsible right. for. One thing that really amazed me, specifically, I remember sitting in on the Uzbek class, how well the students had learned kind of the emotional nature of kind of expressing certain sentiments in Uzbek. Their intonation was really impressive to me. And I think that, again, that's something that, you know, a smaller class can really provide and allow the opportunity for a student to practice.
Is there a bigger picture goal you have in mind that would really satisfy you?
Yeah. I mean, certainly as the incoming director, I am interested in growing the program. I'm certainly interested in having more students from the ASU and the local community college and even the local high school community know about the program and kind of have a good understanding of the possibility for funding that we provide
sure.
With the help of ASU and also our wonderful, the board of the Malikian Center, which is what houses the Critical Languages Institute. I think also we do think of our, you know, mission, you know, why have this, why teach these languages? We think about creating the next cadre of diplomats, the next cadre of military officials, the next cadre of political leaders, foreign policy experts, academics, who, because of their language and cultural fluency, can be both kind of empathetic in the way that they interact with the world, but also, you know, accurate knowledge is something that, for all of those different kind of realms is extraordinarily important. And we think that the kind of nuance that you get through this language and cultural learning that starts with us, we really see ourselves as the starting point to building a pipeline to those kinds of careers for the people who study at CLI.
Almost feels vital and yet underrated. And yet when you define it that way, well, obviously this seems like a natural thing.
Absolutely. So we just had our award ceremony, and one of our students, he was a student in the Albanian class. He's a PhD student in political science at Cornell. He talked about in his speech the fact that over the years 2013 to 2016, the Modern Languages Association has found that colleges across the country have cut 651 foreign language programs. These things are the first things to go on the chopping block a lot of times when there are budget cuts. And at the same time, all across the country, universities and colleges, large and small, I'm thinking of the Barrett, the Honors College, in our case, you know, talk about the importance of creating global citizens, right? And what does it mean to be a global citizen? Well, even the programs that are the language programs that tend to survive, the ones that do have the most enrollments, are, you know, these 15 languages. The first four are Spanish, French, American Sign Language, German, all very important languages. But when we look around, there's so much more world out there that we need to, you know, be citizen diplomats in interacting with, so much more world out there for all these different kinds of career opportunities, and also for these kinds of, you know, self-growth opportunities for our students. I think the worlds of industry, diplomacy, of military intelligence would also say that you need to understand the nuance of expression. You need to understand the nuance and the double meaning of certain parts of language in order to really operate effectively in those areas. And again, we see ourselves as kind of the starting point for our students.
Irina Levin is director of ASU's Critical Languages Institute.
This is Elevate Coffee in the Norterra Shopping Center in North Phoenix. And for the next couple of months, it's also something of an art gallery. The Thunderbird Art Center last week opened a new program called Thunderbird Art Works, which puts the work of four local artists into area businesses. At Elevate Coffee, that means a round room full of paintings. To find out more about this, I met up with Troy Halpern, managing partner of Elevate Coffee Company, and Stephanie Aranda, marketing manager at Phoenix Center for the Arts. And I asked Stephanie to walk me through how the program works.
So Thunderbird Art Center is located in North Phoenix. It's under the umbrella of Central Arts Alliance, along with Phoenix Center for the Arts. So it's a new location. It's in its third year. And at Phoenix Center for the Arts, we have an initiative called Student Art Series, where students submit their artwork, and it's displayed on the walls at our visual arts building. So we wanted to do something similar at Thunderbird Art Center, but there wasn't enough wall space. So while our then-director Joseph Benish and our advancement manager Kate Alschwade were developing the development plan for Thunderbird Art Center, they knew they wanted to do something similar there. And then they also wanted to connect with local businesses and kind of get our name out there in the community since we're pretty new. And that's how Thunderbird Artworks came about.
Troy, how did you get involved? How did Elevate Coffee get involved with this particular program?
Yeah, you know, we're always looking for community involvement, and we jumped right on it.
What about it is appealing to you?
Let's see, art. Art, community. The chance to give an individual artist a chance to showcase what they've done in a small environment, but a busy environment.
Stephanie, how did you figure out which artists and which pieces were going to be hung? Because you have a few different places around this part of town. How do you determine whose work was going to get hung?
Well, instructors and students from Thunderbird Arts Center submitted their artwork to a juried competition, and the winners were selected. So the winners were Nick Ridley, Ed Dubrow, Nancy Price, and Dave Elliott. And we just kind of went from there. We just picked whichever location worked best for them.
how was it trying to find businesses that wanted to be a part of this? I mean, Troy mentioned he was pretty into it from the beginning. Were there others that were also excited to be part of this? Did you have to sort of pitch the idea to folks?
Well, the other location, in addition to Elevate Coffee, is Natalino Italian Restaurant. And the way that it happened was super organic. Our advancement manager, Kate, kind of developed those relationships with Elevate. I think she just came in to grab a coffee and started talking with the person on site, and because she noticed artwork on the walls. So it happened very natural and organically that way.
Troy, what does this do, I guess, for the ambiance? I mean, coffee shops are kind of known for having a certain feel to them. Having local artwork on the walls here, what does that do for you?
Yeah, well, you know, we have a round-shaped room in here we call the Norterra Room, and we love art on the walls. It just kind of showcases the room. You could see it from the large windows that we have, and it just it's colorful, and it's just something that we without it, we feel bare. We just feel bare without the art on the walls.
Do you typically have stuff on the walls before this exhibit starts and after it's over? I mean, do you typically, it looks like you have obviously menus and some screens and stuff, but do you typically have art as well?
During the school year, we enlist about 12 to 15 schools, first through 12th grade, that bring their art over, and we change it out every month. So we try to do art year round, which is great. Well, this program helped us fill this summer void, and hoping that we can continue to work with them year-round.
Stephanie, I think for a lot of folks, when they think about art in the Valley, they think of downtown Phoenix, where you have Roosevelt Row, and you have Grand Avenue, and you have the Art Museum and the Heard Museum. What is the importance of making sure that other parts of town are also connected to the arts?
Oh, it's very important. It's the reason why Thunderbird Arts Center basically exist. At our downtown location, we were experiencing high demand for our classes. We had long wait lists. So we were looking at ways to expand our classes, and we noticed a gap up here in this part of the valley, which is why Thunderbird Arts Center exists.
How else do you try to fill that gap? Obviously, this is part of that, this program, but how else do you try to fill that?
Well, with this initiative, engaging the community, you know, bringing art out of the studios where it's created and into local businesses within this community, we see this as a win-win. You know, artists are able to display and showcase their art, and businesses are able to support local artists.
How challenging is it, or what are the challenges to try to get the arts more incorporated in a part of town like this, where maybe it hasn't been quite as strong as it has been in other parts, or hasn't been associated with other parts of town?
Right. I think there's obviously more representation downtown, but the arts are everywhere. It's just kind of bringing it out to life, and I think this initiative really helps with that.
Troy, you mentioned you tend to have student artwork on the walls around the year. What kind of feedback, if any, do you get from customers? I mean, do they comment on it? Do they notice it while they're sipping their espresso?
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite often that a customer will kind of peruse through the Norterra Room where we display the art, just kind of wondering what's up today. And we also do a little bit of a competition with the schools, in that we invite the family in to vote on the art, and then we give away movie tickets and gift cards for the winners. So yeah, the community is always involved in looking at the art and then actually voting on it sometimes.
Stephanie mentioned the importance of trying to get art out of the studios where it's made and into the community. I would imagine from your perspective, having it here is a big part of that.
Sure. It's funny because I'm looking for art and art's looking for a place to be displayed. They're looking for a place to display their work. So you talked about that challenge of getting it out to the suburbia area more than maybe the inner city. But I think it's just a matter of connecting people like myself with this program and making sure that we make it work.
Stephanie, how will you judge whether or not this initial program is successful?
Well, this is the first time we're doing this, and we definitely want to see ways into how to expand it. The artwork, in addition to being displayed at the locations, they're for sale as well. They're for sale on the thunderbirdarts.org on our website. And I guess just engagement with the community, responses, visits to our website.
Tell me about the importance of having works, you mentioned out of the studios, but specifically in businesses as opposed to galleries or other types of places. What's the importance of having it in a place like this?
I think you're not expecting it to see it here. You know, when you go to a museum, to a gallery, you're going there for one purpose, and it's to see art. You know, when you go to a coffee shop, when you go to a restaurant, you're not necessarily looking to see art, but it's just in an unexpected place. So it's engaging people who wouldn't normally go out to purposely see art.
Maybe reaching an audience that wouldn't otherwise see this kind of stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
That was Stephanie Aranda, marketing manager at Phoenix Center for the Arts. We also heard from Troy Hilpern, managing partner of Elevate Coffee Company. Thunderbird Artworks will be on display through September 13th.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.